The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 13. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi guys, how's everyone doing tonight? I just got back from Cartagena on the Caribbean. It was fantastic over the weekend. Ready to go answer some questions. So let's go ahead and dive right in. Okay, Linda asks, do I sell or rent my fully paid house, about $750K in San Jose? The first question, Linda, is you have to ask what your RV ratio would be. So if you have a house that's worth 750 grand and you own it outright, how much could you get a month per rent? So we want a minimum of 1% RV ratio. That would be $7,500 a month. My guess is you're not getting $7,500 a month in rent for your house. So in that case, it's going to be a better financial decision for you to sell it, take that equity, move it to a linear market, rent out properties that you own, and then for your residents, actually rent that out. So, I did all the math on a video. I think it's rent to buy is the thumbnail. You can check out the specific math, but in the long run, you're going to be a lot better off. Also, you're taking your equity out of a market that's really in a bubble and taking it to a different market that, although the prices aren't cheap, there's a lot less downside because of the price to income ratios. Okay, we've got Jan Carlos, or maybe Juan Carlos. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that. Thank you for the super chat. I said gold to 100 grand. What about silver? Well, to be clear, I didn't necessarily say it would go to 100 grand. I outlined how it could go to 100,000. If gold is at 100,000, silver is right along with it. And you just have to look at history. If you go back and see the last super bull market we had in precious metals, it peaked out in 2011. And you can see kind of what the ratio was, the gold to silver ratio. Or what I did is I looked at a percentage as far as the value or the price of silver as a percentage of the price of gold. And it was about 2.5%. So if gold is at 100,000, silver is probably going to be around 2,500 bucks an ounce. Okay, Third Angel asks, do we have to pay the debt per citizen on the national debt clock? At some point, someone's going to have to pay it. And I want to be careful here because it's not like the United States has to pay off 100% of its debt. We can carry 50% debt to GDP really quite easily, even with normalized interest rates. But the interest on the debt, I think, is a better way of looking at it. If we're running $1 trillion deficits, sooner than later, that you're going to see that reflected directly in tax rates. If interest rates go up and normalize while we're running $1 trillion deficits, we're going to get to that point a lot sooner. So, I mean, it's not that we necessarily have to pay off the entire debt, but the amount of debt we have definitely translates into citizens having to pay increased taxes. I think that's the best way I'd answer that question. Oh, here's my buddy, Suicide Van. Okay. George, I sold all my stocks a few months ago. Okay, bad mistake given the latest rally. Or is this finally the blow off top? No. This is a great question. I'm glad you asked. I really want to encourage everyone to readjust the way you think about investing. And what I mean by that is you have to look at investing like blackjack, in the sense that if you play blackjack well, it doesn't matter if you win a hand or lose a hand. That's not what your objective is. Your objective is to play the game properly and to make decisions, every single decision, based on the probabilities. If you win a hand, great. If you lose a hand, great. But that's not your main objective, because you know that if you play perfectly based on the probabilities, you've got the edge. So in the long run, you are going to come out ahead. It's just the law of large numbers. So unfortunately, most people look at investing as if I go long and it goes up in value, then I made the right decision. That's not always the case. I go back to blackjack and use that as an example. So we all know the game well. And if you're sitting there playing blackjack with a buddy and he or she has a 19 and they ask you, well, should I hit? You say, no, absolutely not. You should not hit on a 19 because the odds are that you're going to lose. And the person says, oh, forget. Yeah, you know, I don't want to listen to that. That's just nonsense. I'm going to go ahead and hit because I've got a good feeling that the next card is going to be a two. You say, okay, whatever you want to do. And sure enough, they hit and they get a two. They get blackjack. And then they look at you and say, oh, see, I told you, if I would have listened to you, then I wouldn't have had all these winnings from me just hitting a blackjack. So did that person make the right decision or the wrong decision? To me, they made the wrong decision, because if they continue to do that, they're going to go bust. And it's the exact same thing when you look at buying stocks or cash flowing rental properties or anything. You don't look at it as did it go up or down. You look at it as did I make the right decision based on the probabilities? And then you take it one step further. And if your investment strategy is like mine, where you try to buy low and sell high, then you just sold high. It doesn't matter if the stock market doubles. It doesn't matter if it triples. The bottom line is you made the correct decision. So if you continue to do that over the long run, you will never pick tops and bottoms. That's a fool's game. But as long as you continue to make those types of decisions, you're going to come out ahead. So it's just buy low, sell high. It's not a matter of buy high and try to sell higher. That doesn't work out. So really, I want to encourage everyone to kind of try to adjust your thinking. Clay asks, first of all, Clay, thanks a lot for making the connection with Jason. That was really, really awesome. And Jason and I go back and forth now almost daily, and we've got so many things in common. That was really, really cool. I appreciate you doing that. So Clay asks, do you expect higher vacancy and turnover in your rentals during the next recession? It really depends on how long and severe the recession is. If we have a short recession where we kind of bounce out of it for whatever reason, the Fed printing money or however it happens, it's most likely that your rents will probably go up, because all those people that now can't afford to buy a home, they lose their savings or a lot of the value of their 401k, then they're your renters. So that would push rents higher, which if you go back and look at 2009, 2012, that's what it did. That said, if we go through an extended recession like the 1930s, then you're going to have behavioral shifts, meaning the U.S. becomes a lot more like the rest of the world in the sense that multiple people live in homes and people live in a lot smaller spaces. So they just adjust the way they live. That could decrease demand overall for rental units because people are consolidating. But that's why I always suggest buying starter homes, because those are going to be the last properties to see the lack of demand really affect your rental rates. And not that it can't, but the people who could rent or buy $300,000 or $400,000 homes before are now going to be your renters or buyers for your $150,000 home. And that's why it's so important to really focus on those linear markets where the price to income is a lot better. But that said, make sure that even if you're getting a starter home, it's in a really, really, really good neighborhood with great school districts. Okay, Matt, thanks for the super chat. Has 10,000 in equity and 10,000 expendable silver. Okay, should I take out equity, sell silver, use as down payment on a rental property in Nashville? Then I'd be in stocks, metal, real estate. I'm assuming, Matt, when you say that you've got 10,000 in equity, maybe you're saying that, I don't know, buddy. If you've got 10,000 in equity that you're talking about extracting from your residence and then combining that with 10 grand in silver, that's a little thin, because you're going to want to buy a property that's at least 100 grand. Anything less than that, and you're going into the neighborhoods that I don't like. You're just dealing with some tough tenants. Yeah, I don't know if you'd have enough of a, call it an emergency fund for your rental property. Even if you have one or two rental properties, you want about 5 grand at least in case a hot water heater goes out or you've got to fix a foundation, something like that. So I would wait. I would hold off until you've got maybe 30 grand to play with, so you can use 20 grand as a down payment and then have 10 as kind of like an emergency fund. I just bust my butt at work or do whatever I could to save another 10 grand and then make that move. But I do think you're looking at this correctly, Matt. Ideally, if you've got some stocks, metals, and real estate, well, I don't know about stocks, but if you've got metals and real estates, as long as your stocks, you understand that is a speculation and it is not an investment, and that's a very small percentage of your portfolio, then you've got some diversification there. And I think that would probably make sense. A progressive opinion. Thank you for the super chat. Asks, how do you feel about gold mining stocks as a hedge against imminent downturn this year? I don't like it as a hedge, but I like it. I like gold mining stocks, but I like them as a speculation. The hedge for me would be physical gold. That's the insurance. And just to reiterate, I know you guys have heard this a million times, but just in case there's some people that are kind of wondering what I'm talking about, I like to compartmentalize my portfolio into three buckets. You've got investments, and that has to pay you to own it. That's how I define an investment. That's about 80% of my portfolio. 10% in insurance, which really the only insurance for me is physical gold. And then 10% in speculation. And that would be how I would define that, is if I'm buying something because I think it's going to go up in price, then that is a speculation. So the gold mining stocks would fall into that category. Also like silver for that as well. It's a great speculation, but that also offers you a little bit of insurance. It's just more of kind of like a hybrid. So I like the stocks, but not for the reason you're implying. Hey, Bob asks, is Trump doing good or bad with the economy? What's your view? I can't trust the mainstream media anymore. Well, I definitely agree. You can't trust the mainstream media. That is for sure. As far as Trump doing a good job, I mean, I don't like any politicians, Bob. I don't like the people on the right. I don't like the people on the left. I think they're all crooks, with the exception of Ron Paul. But Trump, if I had to give him a strictly on the economy, it really depends on how you would define that. So if you would define that as doing what's right for the long term, then no. Not at all. I mean, he's running trillion-dollar deficits, for heaven's sakes. I mean, he's done some things that are okay and then some things that aren't really that great. But if you're just grading him on just the very short term, so just for the next year or just as he's been president, yeah, then I think he's done what he's needed to do to prop up the bubble economy, as Peter Schiff would say. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you define that as good or bad, just propping up a bubble that in the long run is going to be more detrimental than it would have been if we just would have let the air out of it in the beginning and done a 1920-21 type of reset, as opposed to trying to prop everything up with this excess liquidity, creating more malinvestment, which is just going to make matters worse when the day comes that we have to pay the fiddler. Okay, Kevin asks, what's the best strategy for someone with $100,000 in cash? Well, Kevin, I don't know your personal situation. So it's just so different from person to person. And I can't really give an investment advice, but I can tell you what I would do personally if I had $100,000 in cash. And that is, I would put $10,000 into physical gold. I'd have $10,000 for speculation. And again, that's buying something that you think is going to go up in price. And then I'd take probably 50 of that and try to buy a couple solid rental properties. And then I'd take the rest, I'd leave it in cash and put it in the T-bills, just short-term, 3 months, 6 months, roll them over. So you've got some dry powder. So when we do go into a recession and asset prices deflate, then you're there with cash ready to take advantage of those opportunities. That's how I'd roll it. For all, thank you for the super chat, asks, do you consider dividend paying stocks as assets that pay you, or is that only property? I don't want to be a landlord. No, I totally. Yeah, absolutely. If you've got, I use the example of Coca-Cola. I think Coca-Cola is a fantastic stock. I would love to buy Coca-Cola, but not at this price. It's all about price. So if the stock market got cut in half like it did in 2009, and you could buy Coke at $20 or $25 a share and pick up a 6 or 7% dividend yield all day long, I love it. And that would definitely be an investment, or how I would define an investment. So I know there's a lot of opportunity overseas for dividend paying stocks. I don't know for sure, but it would surprise me if there were opportunities in the US. You just have to do the homework. It's all about homework. And that's where most people don't have the discipline, I think, to do that. And that's why I typically suggest real estate. And also because real estate, you can use 30-year fixed rate debt or mortgage, which is getting paid to short the dollar. And you've got tax benefits. There's a lot of reasons why, if I'm someone with like 20 or 30 grand, that real estate makes a heck of a lot more sense. But to answer your specific question, I absolutely consider dividend paying stocks investments and not speculation, because you're really just buying the income stream. Reggie asks, is Tesla worth investing into? No, it's not. And that's not to say that I hate Tesla or anything like this. I think the cars are really cool, and I'm a car guy. But it's just, where's the value? Where it's not cheap. It's ridiculously expensive. It's so expensive. And even if you think that Tesla is going to be the next Volkswagen, or the Volkswagen of electric cars, or they're going to have they're going to have robo-taxis and all these things, it doesn't mean that the stock is cheap. The stock is still super, super expensive. And just remember, it just goes back to what we learned in first grade. You want to buy low and sell high. And you don't want to buy high and try to sell higher. And I think that's what you'd be doing if you're going into Tesla right now. Okay, we got a question. I'm 100% in on gold and silver. How much would you suggest to retire with? 100 ounces of gold. Well, I'm assuming that you're saying that 100% of your assets are in gold and silver. If that's what you're saying, I wouldn't suggest that. I don't think that's a good idea. And again, I can't give specific investment advice, but if this were me, I'm looking at what my monthly expenses are, and say there it's $3,000, I'd have no confidence that I'm getting Social Security. Or if I do, you know, what the purchasing power of that Social Security check would be monthly. So I'm looking at how I can buy something that's going to pay me $2,000 or $3,000 a month to own it so I can cover my expenses. And then once I've got that, then I look at gold, make sure I've got the insurance policy there, and maybe have that silver as a speculation that could potentially be a big home run. That's how I look at it. But to be clear, I think having 100% of your portfolio in any asset class is not a good idea. It's just, remember the third rule, you've got to diversify. So, and it looks like I accidentally skipped a question here from my buddy Gio Rob. Good to see you again on the chat. I really hope that we had a consultation with Gio Rob, and I hope that that's served you well. Gio Rob says, thanks for your hard work and videos. Hoping to get my first rental property purchased next month. Very cool. Awesome. Your Brent Johnson video was interesting. Do you agree that the USD could continue to be a bubble as he suggests? Very interesting take on things. Yeah, I do. The question becomes, what's the probability of that happening? Is it 50-50? Is it 10%? Is it 90%? That's where you've got to go back and watch that video. And I'd strongly suggest everyone, if you haven't watched that Brent Johnson video that I did, the entire interview, make sure you take some time this week to watch that. I think you'll get a lot of value. And he's such a smart guy, and he's very humble in understanding that he could be wrong. He thinks he's right, and he's making some big bets that he's right. But he looks at things the way I think you should. And that's that it's not that I'm certain and gold's going to $100,000 an ounce. I know it. So go out there and do this, because this is what's certainly going to happen. He doesn't do that. He says, this is what I think is going to happen. This is where you should position yourself. But it's not someone who just says, oh, I just spouts off opinions. It's so well researched, and there's so much fact that he gives so much data and factual evidence to back up his claims. It's a very compelling argument. To be clear, Brent believes, just like all of us do, that the end game for the dollar is down. He sees the dollar collapsing as well, but in the short term, he sees it really going up. So I can't get into all the reasons why on the live stream, but we take a deep dive into that on that live video. So I'm sorry, on that interview. So again, if you haven't had the chance to look at that, check that out. And I want to make sure I answer your question thoroughly, Gio Rob. So my take on that is that I fall into the same camp as Eric Townsend, my buddy that's the host of Macro Voices. And it's just about finding people who are really smart, who are practitioners, meaning they've got skin in the game. They got money on the line and a lot of their own money on the line. You find those people with different opinions, and you listen to both of them with an open mind. And then you say, okay, well, Luke Groman is saying this, or Peter Schiff is saying this, or Jim Rogers is saying this, Jim Rickards is saying this, Ray Dalio is saying this, Jeff Gundlach is saying this, Druckenmiller is saying this, Brent Johnson is saying this. And you just absorb all of that information. You say, okay, based on this, or based on what I'm hearing from all of these smart people, what do I think the probabilities of XYZ happening? And then that's how you go ahead and make your decisions, while at the same time doing as much research as you possibly can on your own. Okay, Coda, thanks for the super chat. Coda asks, crash before consumer inflation or straight to consumer inflation? Hopefully I understand your question. I assume that you're talking about, are we going to have deflation, price deflation or go straight to price inflation. I think having price deflation, if you're talking about consumer prices, would be low, a very low probability. Even if you look at the crash that we had in 2009, if you look at the CPI, it didn't go down. We had negative GDP, but we didn't have consumer price deflation. And that's the way the government measures it. And most of us would agree that inflation is quite a bit higher than what the government tells us. But you can have asset deflation. And that's what I see happening. Asset deflation and probably price inflation. And it's just a matter of how much consumer inflation will we have? Will that be 2, 3, 4, 5%? Or will it be 20 or 25% or more? That's really my line of thinking on that. Okay, Derek, thanks for the super chat. Asks, know anything about midstream oil MLPs? I don't. I know that Kiyosaki likes them for the tax benefits, but that's it. I apologize, Derek. I haven't done too much research on that. Jonathan, thanks for the super chat. Asks, can you expand on why you think it's safer to keep cash in T-bills as opposed to a checking account? Also, what maturity to be able to remain liquid enough to take advantage of market opportunities? That's a great question, Jonathan. If you have your bank, or excuse me, if you have your money in a bank, it's their money. So it's legally theirs. So although it may be an asset on your balance sheet, it's a liability on the bank's balance sheet, and they take that money and they can, to a certain extent, do what they want with it. Especially if you've got your money in a money market account or fund or a CD. And I know you're talking about checking accounts specifically, so I'll focus on that. But I mean, who knows where that money's going? And if you watch some of my more recent videos, you'll see that I show how that very well could be going into the repo market, or even more likely into the FX swap market. And then it goes to Europe, which could potentially go to Deutsche Bank or any of those other usual suspects that none of us would really want to lend money to. But as far as a checking account, because your counterparty risk is the bank, and then people say, well, that's not too much counterparty risk because the FDIC insures it. But they forget that the savings and loan crisis in the late 80s, early 90s, that's when the predecessor of the FDIC went bust. So, and then you look at the assets that the fund, the FDIC has, and it's anywhere from, I mean, I've read varying numbers, but it's anywhere from 25 billion up to 100. And let's just say it's 100. Okay, well, that's insuring 9 trillion plus in customer deposits. So that doesn't make me feel very good. And so I guess the short answer is that I think your counterparty risk is far lower in T-bills than it is in the banking system. And it's not to say you don't keep, you know, 5-10 grand in the bank to pay your bills, but anything that you want to keep specifically for dry powder to take advantage of the stock market going down, or maybe a real estate opportunity that presents itself, I just suggest those T-bills. As far as the maturity, I think you'd be okay with 3 months, 6 months, just depending on, it's kind of a pain in the butt because you got to roll them over yourself. But if you didn't mind doing that, my sister does that. And as she said, it takes her about 10 or 20 minutes to do that. I'd just do it in 3 month T-bills because the interest rates as flat as the yield curve is, are pretty much the same. And then that just gives you a little additional liquidity. So why is it less counterparty risk? Because the government, although I don't like it, they can always just print money, or the Fed can just print money to make them whole. And it is true that if the FDIC went bust, then the Fed would probably bail them out. But why go through the hassle? I just think T-bills, it's the way to go. And also, I want to point out that if you look at guys like Buffett and a lot of those really smart investors that have done well for long periods of time that manage billions and billions of dollars. That's exactly what they do. Okay, Progressive Opinion asks, the global economy collapses tomorrow. The dollar quickly loses value. You have to bet $1 million right now. Would you bet on the return of the gold standard or more MMT insanity? MMT insanity. For sure. The central bankers believe wholeheartedly that what they did in 2009 fixed everything. That whenever we have a problem, we meaning the economy, all you have to do to fix it is just lower interest rates and print money. And they think that it worked. No inflation, or what, how they measure it. And they've got a system that isn't, that didn't collapse. So ironically enough, their belief system is even more entrenched than it was prior to 2009. So if all they have is the QE money printing hammer, the next time we have a problem, regardless of the severity, that's their default. And the worse the problem is, or the more severe the collapse, the more they're just going to try to do more of what they think was and is the solution. So if we get to the zero bound, well, we just need to go negative. If negative 1% doesn't work, well, we just need negative 3. If that doesn't work, well, we just need negative 10. If 10 trillion, if expanding the Fed's balance sheet to 10 trillion, meaning they print an additional 6 trillion, if that doesn't work, well, we just got to print another 10 trillion. And if that doesn't work, we just got to print another 100 trillion. It just never ends. The only thing that ends is when the entire system collapses and the whole world says, forget it. We are sick and tired of fiat money. It was an experiment. We did it for 40, 50 years. Now it's time to go back to the type of money system that we had for the first 5,000 years. And that's when we have a paper currency or a digital currency that's backed by a hard asset. But that's the end game. And I think there's a lot of activity and a lot of decisions that will be made prior to the market and the world forcing those decisions upon the politicians and the central bankers. Conrad, thanks for the super chat. Conrad asks, how will the reset look? All debts wiped out from all. So you're talking about a debt jubilee. I think the reset is an inflationary greater depression. I think my buddy Eric said it perfectly on our interview. And again, that's not to say that the dollar won't go up. It's not to say that we won't go through deflation, especially asset deflation. But I think that the end game is that the Fed and all central banks paint themselves into a corner where they take away their only tool, which again is money printing and quantitative easing. If we get inflation running at 10, 15, or just the 1970s, they cannot print money into that. It'll exacerbate the problem and just bring on the end game a lot faster. So if they can't print money, if they can't do QE, what can they do? Nothing. So you basically don't have a central bank. And we go back to the free market. And that, in my opinion, is the end game. And if they tried to do anything, keeping interest rates low, it's just, or doing more money printing, that's just going to make it inflation worse. And you just get this doom vortex, if you want to call it that. That's just this cycle that it's just the more they do, the worse it gets. And I think that's the end game and how the reset will look. Question, Lynette Zhang says, after collapse, you can get property cheap. So I'm 100% gold and silver. Am I thinking this wrong? Yes. In my opinion, and that's not to say that that someone who has that opinion is just completely crazy. I totally get it. I totally understand that train of thought. I want to be clear. But for me personally, I just don't think for me personally, I wouldn't do that. And I wouldn't do that because gold and silver does not pay you to own it. And although we could go through a collapse, we most likely will. Does that happen in 5 years? Does that happen in 5 months? Does that happen in 10 years? I don't know. And if it happens in 10 years, there's going to be a huge opportunity cost in you having all of your net worth in an asset that doesn't pay you. I mean, just do the math on how much positive cash flow that you would make from a rental property opposed to gold over the next 10 years, if that's how long it takes to get to this inflationary spiral that I was talking about earlier. It would allow you to buy so much more gold. I mean, that's the thing. You could take the cash flow from the rental property and just continue to build up your gold and silver position, or the cash flow from whatever's paying you dividends. You know, maybe it's a foreign dividend stock, something like that. And then also too, if you're buying gold or silver to short the dollar, the real estate's doing that as long as you're using 30-year fixed rate debt, because if the rate of inflation, or when the rate of inflation exceeds the interest rate, the spread is a transfer of wealth from the lender to the borrower. That's why I always say it's a way of getting paid to short the dollar. And that's really the bottom line. I don't think if it were me, I wouldn't do that. That's the best way I can say it. Alexander, thanks for the super chat, Alexander. Massachusetts home prices, looking at 410, three units. Wow, that's great. I know Boston's really kind of bubbly right now, but if you're in Massachusetts and you can get like a triplex that for 410 that cranks out $4,500 a month in rent, I think that looks like a pretty good deal to me. You got the 1% RV ratio, especially if you could live in one of the units and it still throws off positive cash flow. As most of you know, house hacking is in my opinion the best financial decision that anyone can possibly do, because then it allows you to take that money that you would have spent on housing, which is 99% of Americans' biggest expense, and invest it. And if you can do that every single month for 30 years, you're going to be doing really well. That's you've got your own retirement plan. So I think that's that. I would definitely consider that, as long as it's not in the ghetto, Alexander, or as long as it's in an area that's desirable with a good school district, where you're going to attract quality renters, that you don't have to worry about destroying the place or collecting rent, then I think I would definitely consider it. Wally or Wooly asks, thanks for the super chat, by the way. I've heard that it's the bond market that will collapse everything. Is this because debt Ponzi scheme will run out of borrowers? Or is it because of a massive sell-off by the speculators or something else? It's pretty much all of the above. Because although I don't know that it's not exactly a Ponzi scheme, although I can totally see how you'd argue that. But really what happens is if interest rates go up, you're going to have a lot less buyers for that debt. And or you're going to have a lot, that's what's going to cause interest rates to go up when the market forces take over and they can see that they're going to be paid back with currency that has less purchasing power, and the interest rate or lack thereof that they're getting just doesn't make any sense whatsoever for the amount of risk that they have. then the buyers leave, interest rates go up, and then that means you're running out of lenders, really. Now, will they run out of borrowers? I don't think they'll run out of borrowers. That's the government will always be there to borrow and spend as much as they possibly can. So I don't think they're going to run out of borrowers. But I think they run out of lenders. Hey, Conrad, thanks for the super chat again. Conrad asks, Schiff's Gold Fund, the only safe one around. I don't know about that, because I'm assuming you're talking about Schiff's Gold Fund that invests in the gold miners, not necessarily to play physical gold. And I think there'd probably be more funds out there that invest in miners that I would consider, although I'd also consider Schiff's. I know he charges a little bit more, but he has fantastic performance on his main gold fund. So I don't know that it's the only safe one around, but I definitely consider it. What I would not consider is a gold fund that was just a way to play the price of physical gold. Graham, thank you for the super chat. Graham asks, why do I keep seeing the date of 14th of January as a significant date in the financial economy? I'm not sure. I've seen that pop up here. I think that might be more of a conspiracy theory, but that said, I haven't looked into it. So the people that I listen to, the Real Vision and the Macro Voices, I haven't heard them bring it up. So that's why I haven't necessarily researched it. But I'm not too concerned with it myself, but I have an open mind. Okay, Carlos says, because January 14th is the China, supposedly, when they sign the trade deal, and if they don't sign the trade deal, then that could be damaging to markets. But if it is, and the Fed's just going to come in and drop interest rates, and that's going to make the market go right back up because they're adding more liquidity, I really think that I was focusing on 2020 being the recession and things getting, or most likely, again, no certainties, only probabilities. But then I watched that interview with Druckenmiller, and he made a fantastic point that in his career, he's never seen us go into a recession or have a stock market crash when the Fed was easing interest rates, only when they're tightening. And I went back and researched that, and he's right on the money. So it's not that it can't happen. It's just if it's never happened in the past, then it's a higher probability that we're probably going to wait until the Fed starts increasing interest rates again to have a nasty, nasty downturn. And are they going to do that in a election year? Most likely not. Hey, Progressive Opinion, thanks for the super chat. Just how rough do you see the end game being? No food on shelves. That would surprise me in the United States. Not that it can't happen. So if you're the type of person that, you know, the bug out type of person or the prepper, I don't think that's a bad idea. I don't think there's any downside to doing that, unless you're letting it just completely consume your life. But if I'm looking at the probabilities, I don't think that's the most likely outcome for the United States. I would see it being more like what Argentina is going through right now than what Venezuela is going through. But it's a possibility. So I think what I would do if I really wanted to see what that end game looks like, I would look and try to study what's happening right now in Argentina and kind of use that as my base case and say, okay, what are they going through? So how would that play out in the United States? And if that's my base case, then how do I prepare myself for that type of situation? The thing that the United States has going for it, let me insert that, because I always talk about how the economy is fragile and how bad things are. But let me talk about what the U.S. has going for it. And that is, number one, infrastructure. So you've got a highway system there that is incredible. And that might not seem like a big deal, but it is a huge, huge boost for the economy. To be able to deliver goods that quickly across the country is a massive advantage. And I know that being in Colombia. As an example, the two major cities in Colombia are Bogota and Medellin. If we had an I-5, like, or a Highway 10, like we have in the United States, it would take you maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours to drive from Medellin to Bogota. And we're not talking about small cities. We're talking about cities with 10 million people, one with 4 million people. We're not talking about little villages off in the Amazon somewhere. So right now, because they don't have a highway system, it takes you like 8 or 9 hours to get to Bogota. Think that through. What if it took you just to drive from Phoenix to Dallas? What if that took you 4 days? I mean, what if it took you 2 weeks to drive from one side of the United States to the other side? What would that do to our economy? That's huge as far as GDP. So that doesn't go away. And I understand that we could have the grid go down and there's a lot of problems there, but there's a lot of infrastructure that we have. We also have human capital. We've got a group of people who are extremely productive relative to other countries. And it's not that they're any better than people or other people aren't as hardworking or lack intelligence. That's not what I'm saying at all. But we have the tools because of all of the investment that we've had throughout the past 200 years. And because of the Industrial Revolution, a lot of other things in the computer age, we have all of these tools that make us more productive. That doesn't go away over the long run. It could short term. And lastly, I would put up our, and I want to make sure that people don't take this the wrong way, but I would take our, the American, I would take our 1% and match them up against any other country's 1%. And when I mean the 1%, don't get me wrong, I am not talking about the top 1% as far as their net worth. Not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about our top 1% producers, like the people that are highly, highly productive, the entrepreneurs that are out there building businesses. And they don't just build one business. They build multiple businesses. The guys like Gary Vaynerchuk, like he is an example of what I would consider the 1% crowd in the United States that is just wildly productive and just creating jobs and creating value and products and services that just make everyone's life better. If you look at Silicon Valley and the entrepreneurial skill set that we have out there, and these guys and gals that not just start one business, they start multiple businesses that really have an impact on people's lives. And they just do it over and over and over and over again. That's the 1% that I'm talking about. If it were like an Olympic sport, I would put them up against anyone in or any other country's top 1% producers. And I think that we would win hands down. That's another thing that the U.S. has going for it. But the problem with that is that if the U.S. goes into an Argentina type of situation, who are they going to go after? Ironically, they're going to go after the Gary Vaynerchuks. It's just the way it is. And those guys or girls are going to have a target on their back. And it is possible for the government to push them too far. It's like an Atlas Shrugged type of situation where everyone's just like, I'm out of here. I'm going the John Galt route and just see you later. I've had enough. That is very possible. And I know I get a lot of pushback on this, and people say, "Oh, if we raise taxes to 80 or 90%, you know, the highest marginal rate, that's not going to make anyone leave." And oh, it's going to happen in every country in the United States. And these high income people or high producing people, they don't want to live in some third world country like Colombia or something like that. And I know that whenever I hear someone say that, number one, I know that they haven't traveled much, because they're under the opinion that just the United States is the greatest place on earth, and just you cannot find anything that's as far as from a standard of living like the United States. And that's just not true. Not true at all. So you can push those people away. And I think Puerto Rico is a fantastic example of this. They set up Act 20 and 22 back in, I think, 2013 or so. I was one of the first people that I know that went to Puerto Rico for that reason. But now if you go back, oh my gosh, look at all the people that went to Puerto Rico, all the producers that went to Puerto Rico as a result of just being fed up with California. I mean, thousands of people. So now they're not producing jobs in California anymore. They're producing them in Puerto Rico. And the worse it gets in the United States, the more you're going to see that happen. And those same people that push back on me when I say that, I just give them my example. Listen, as an entrepreneur before I retired, I created thousands of jobs. I'm not at the same time. The biggest business I ever had just over 100 employees. But over the span of my entrepreneurial career, thousands of jobs. Now, what am I doing? I'm not doing that in the United States anymore. Now, again, in retirement, I'm not producing that many jobs. But right now, I probably employ, through all my real estate projects indirectly, probably 30 people, 35 people. And those are jobs that I would have been creating in retirement in the United States if I personally would not have been pushed too far. And there's a lot of variables there too, or there's a lot of reasons that I had, but that was definitely one of them. All right, let me get back on track here. I went off on a tangent. Andreas, thanks for the super chat, asks, what is a good debt leverage to be downturn resistant? Would you pool to buy a multi-unit with $100,000 to $300,000 or go it alone? Go it alone, if it were me. I like being in control of my own investments. I really don't like, I mean, think about that. You're going into real estate because it's a long-term investment for you, and you're doing it specifically to buy a stream of cash flow. If that's the rationale that I'm going into it, I would want as little counterparty risk as possible. And the more partners you have, or the more you invest into a fund or a pool of other investors where one guy or girl is managing it, you don't know how much they're paying themselves or if they're doing a good job. And no one's going to invest other people's money as well as they invest their own. It just won't happen. They're not going to be as careful with your money as you will be. So if I had the opportunity, I would definitely go at it alone. Okay, Hi Viz Economist, thank you for the super chat again. All right, and your vlogs were fantastic and well-produced. Thank you very much. That's, I got to give all the credit to the editors there, and the fact that I did a TV show. A lot of you might not know that was pretty much the genesis of the YouTube channel. Is earlier this year, I produced a TV show in Medellin that was just your typical house flipping show, because that's what we were doing, and I figured, well, why not just film it and turn it into a TV show? So I did it, and that's where I got all these awesome editors. But when the first season was over, I didn't really like dealing with the network, which goes back to Andreas's question. So I said, well, I've got all this awesome human capital. How do I leverage it? Let's go ahead and start a YouTube channel. And the rest is history. So not to go off on a tangent there, let me get back to the question. Now that you have so many more viewers since you went macro, try that again. I bet it'll be a big hit. On dates, Dalio still is short until March 2019 Q4. The report hits January 30th. Okay. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that could change between now and January 30th. But I appreciate the intel. That's really, really good to know. In fact, I really want to research that myself to see that what's going on in that report. That'll be cool. But yeah, as far as the vlogs, you're right. They just weren't that popular. And the thing that was really interesting about the YouTube channel, when I first set it up, most of the content was geared toward real estate investing. I know as much or even more about real estate investing as I do about macro. So I thought that's what most people would want to watch. Oddly enough, I like talking about macro 1,000 times more than I like talking about real estate. I like real estate. I just don't like it. It just isn't an interesting topic for me to really dive into and try to push myself intellectually to try to figure out. It's not like this Rubik's Cube. Once you get real estate, you kind of get it, where macro is just always changing. And it's just such an interesting game of chess that it really fascinates me a lot more. So when I started doing a couple videos on macro, because I wanted to articulate my thoughts in video form, just as kind of a way to get things off my chest. And oddly enough, those were the most popular videos by far. And that's when the channel really took off. So everything worked out well, because that's what I like talking about the most. But as far as the vlogs, I think probably what we'll do is do more vlogs, and I'll probably put them up on my real estate investing Facebook group, which, if you guys want to check that out, it's Medellin Real Estate Investors. And you can just go there and click the follow button or whatever, and it's a closed group, so I've got to let you in. But just go ahead and do that if you guys want, and I'll probably post the vlogs there. But I might try to do a couple more, especially like the before and afters, because everyone likes to see those, when I can take a property, and I'm in the middle of a few projects right now where we're going to be done with them in the next few months. So I'll have a lot more content to turn into that before and after stuff, which I think is what everyone likes to see. So, all right, Conrad, thanks again for the super chat, Conrad. Is it worth buying a first-time home in California? No, it is not. Easy question. Unless you're good enough at finding a deal, and if you were to find a seller that is so motivated, and you can and pick up a deal where you could cash flow it at a 1% or higher RV ratio, or if you can house hack, Conrad, and find like a triplex or a fourplex opportunity, and it's cash flow positive while you're living in one of the units, then I don't care where it is. I don't care if it's in California. I don't care if it's in, I was going to say Detroit, but I wouldn't really care where it was, as long as the numbers work. But keep in mind, even if the numbers work, you are taking a little bit more risk, or actually substantially more risk in California, not necessarily because that the value of the triplex or fourplex would go down, but I think that because of their pension fund issues, they're going to have to raise property taxes at some point in time. And I think they're going to be raising property tax while they're implementing all this rent control. So it's going to, and then they're probably going to increase the state income tax. So you've got all this external downside that could add a lot more risk to that type of investment. Zach, thanks for the super chat. Would you buy 40 acres in Idaho? No, I would not, Zach, because that doesn't pay me to own it. And I have lost, how can I say this? Since 2012, 99% of the real estate deals I've done, I've made money. I've made a lot of money. But there has been a couple deals where I have lost money. And I'll be the first person to admit it. And the only deals where I've lost money is where I've bought land. And your liquidity goes down, and it could take you 3-4 years to sell it. And it's a lot tougher to leverage the equity. And I think it's so much better to buy an asset of real estate that's paying you, not just for the cash flow, but it's so much easier to sell. There's so many more buyers for a single family home than there is for 40 acres in Idaho. And now I want to be clear. I don't know what you might use that 40 acres for. As an example of that, I've got some buddies in Kansas City who I'm not sure if they purchased the land or they purchased the land, and then they lease it to guys who are really big into hunting. So you get these deer hunter guys that pay them to lease the land just to try to, I'm not sure, I'm not a big hunter myself, but just so they can hunt the land, basically. They set up all these cameras to watch the deer and try to find them. And so that's a way that you could get that piece of property cash flowing for you. So then I'd like it, but it still would be the liquidity. I wouldn't like it as much as single family because of the lower liquidity level. But I think you get my point on that. Kimchi Man, thank you very much for the super chat. I will start my blockchain startup next month. Hey, congratulations. Very cool. I have cash seed money, okay, but I don't know where to hold. I already have gold, silver, Bitcoin, but I don't want to invest in the stock market. Are you talking about, I'm going to assume that you're talking about you don't know where to hold the money that you're going to be using as seed capital for your startup, in which case, T-bills. Tom, thanks for the super chat, Tom. Hi, George. Jason says, refi till you die. You got it. I understand that you can build up the asset side of the balance sheet this way, but is there a strategy that you would like which creates both cash flow and equity? Yeah. If you're extracting that equity to buy more cash flow, then that's why I would do it. I mean, Jason takes it out, or one of his suggestions is to take it out and use it as your living expenses because you're doing it tax-free. But I like taking it out and just using it to buy more cash flow. In other words, more rental properties. And in which case you're building your cash flow and you're building your equity. So that's how I would do it. Progressive Opinion, thanks a lot for the super chat. Would you buy preferred stock in an American mining or natural resource producer? In other words, do you bet on American soil being dug for profit? I don't know enough of that. I don't know enough about that to give you a really educated answer. What I would say is I've been listening to a few podcasts lately where Marin Katusa talks about this, and he's actually been able to make quite a bit of money on American soil. But he structures his deals in a very sophisticated manner. But I would suggest listening to a few of those and then taking the next step. I'm just trying to think this through to see if I can give you any better answer than that. I mean, if it were me, I would do that first. And then, You know, also too, I know that I heard Schiff talking the other day that there's one gold miner that's actually in the S&P 500, and they pay like a 2 or 3% dividend yield. That's probably where I'd start. I'd look at that and research that first, and listen to some of Marin's stuff and try to make a decision that way. Okay, hi Viz Economist, thank you very much. Sorry about that. He says, Keith McCullough recently was on Real Vision, explained Q4 GDP growth will be 0%. Okay, cool. Yeah, Keith is a super smart guy. It comes out January 30th in 2 weeks. Stocks might get smoked. Oh, I see what you're saying. So the Q4 GDP report comes out January 30th. Honestly, I don't know that stocks would get smoked. It's so perverse. But the reason I say that is because the market's in this good news is good news and bad news is good news. it's so structurally unsound that it just boggles the mind that we would be, the United States would be in that position. But I think that might be what you could see. That would be my base case. Is that if we get a good number, then stocks are going to go to the moon. And if we get a bad number, stocks are going to go to the moon, because then everyone thinks that the Fed is going to come in, drop interest rates, print more money, and we just, it's the same broken record. So I don't think I think that the probability is high that that comes to fruition as far as the bad GDP report. But I don't think that, my base case would not be stocks going down as a result, maybe just short term, maybe a couple, like a day or two, but then everyone would snap back and say, oh, wait a minute. And then most likely the Fed would come out and make some sort of statement that would be extremely dovish, and the market just goes right back to all time highs. Jill, thanks for the super chat. Jill, any ideas beside T-bills on where to hold cash until an opportunity comes along? My next choice would be a checking account or savings account, not a money market or CD, with a huge bank like B of A or Wells Fargo, because they're so systemically important that if they get into problems, the Fed's going to bail them out. Boom, just like that. Most likely. And there's a high probability of it, but it's not 100% certain like the T-bills are. I would either go that direction, or I would do the complete opposite. That is going to a really small bank, like a local bank, where you knew the guys and gals making the decisions, and you knew what their loan book looked like and how much risk they were taking. As an example, the bank that I deal with in Kansas City, that I use for all my line of credits and all the stuff that I do with my real estate there. It's a bank named Country Club Bank, and they're just local in Kansas City. They only fund in Kansas City. And a real good buddy of mine is the VP of commercial lending. And I didn't go there for that reason. I was actually referred to them. And then as a result of all the business that I've done with them over the years, I've just become really good friends with this gentleman. And they keep almost, what they do, they keep all their loans on their books. They don't sell loans to Fannie and Freddie. They just do old school banking. And as a result of that, their default rate, and this is commercial lending, not necessarily just their residential book, but this gentleman shared with me the stats on their commercial lending book, and their default rate was only 3% during the great financial crisis. That is some prudent investing, and or prudent lending, I should say. So if you knew your local, and it's not just, I see someone talk about credit unions, it's not just the fact that they're small. They can be small and take extreme risks that you would want no part of. It's just about if you've got a relationship with the decision makers at that bank, and you trust their decision making, and they kind of open up their books and you can see what type of loans that they make. And if they're making very prudent old school type loans, and then I'd ask them what their track record was in the past or over the GFC. And if they've got a fantastic track record, and then I would go that direction. So it's one or the other. And I wouldn't do anything in the middle. Thanks for the super chat. Cody asks, do you ever see farmland in the Midwest coming down in price? I live in mid-Missouri. Oh, cool. Yeah, I've been there many times. And the price is astronomical. Yeah, I know. I know farmland, it's really brutal there. I've got a lot of friends out there that do that. I don't know enough about it, Cody, to give you a good answer. If I wanted, I'm assuming you might not be a farmer, but you're just looking at a speculative play. I might look at something that would be directly tied to farmland, but would be a lot cheaper. So like something in the ag space that was a play on farmland, but just wasn't so overpriced. Yeah, that's how I'd go about that. A question, George, do you advise to pay off your first mortgage of current home, then get a HELOC before purchasing your first rental? Not really. I'm going to assume that the mortgage you're talking about is a 30-year fixed rate. I don't think I'd pay that off. I'd take the cash and just use the cash that you would have paid off the mortgage and just use that to buy the rental properties with a little bit of leverage, maybe 50% LTV. Now, if that house is in a really cyclical market that's in a bubble right now, I'd consider taking out all the equity and moving it somewhere. But that's a video or a live stream in and of itself on how to and on explaining that. But the short answer is I don't think I'd pay it off. I just have the cash and keep the cash in T-bills until you find a great rental property, then pull the trigger. Hey, Zach, thanks for the super chat. Zach, oh boy, this is a good question. Zach asks, $30,000 in Bitcoin or a poker career, which is safer? I'm not sure which would be safer, Zach. I mean, that depends on how good you are at poker. I mean, if you're the best poker player in the world, then that's going to be a lot safer. The reason I'm really trying to think this through is blackjack was really the catalyst for me making all the money that I did. I think I would have got there at some point in time just because I'm such a kind of a driven type of person. But I think I got there a lot sooner in life. And I actually sent out a tweet about this earlier today that I was a self-made millionaire by the age of 34, retired at the age of 38. And I don't think I would have. And while I know that I would not have done that quickly if I would not have learned to count cards and play blackjack. It was instrumental, to say the least, in my entrepreneurial career. And it's also been extremely instrumental in how I look at investing and really how I look at life in general as just a game of probabilities. And so my point is that although the poker career might not be safer, if you're able to learn the things from playing poker that I learned playing blackjack, then I think that would be a better way to go. But see, that said, you could learn that stuff without doing poker as a career. I don't know, man. It's just such a difficult question because I don't know you individually. I don't know what your skill sets are. But I think the best way for me to answer that question is to say, if you've only got $30,000, I wouldn't put it all in Bitcoin because it's a speculation. But I do think Bitcoin's a great speculation, but it's just it needs to be a small portion of your portfolio. I also think that the benefits of learning to play poker professionally are far more substantial than just a monetary gain. If you can learn to look at the world through the lens of probabilities and reading people, you're going to have a huge edge whatever you decide to do long term. Nathan asks, George, I recently went on a... Wait a minute here. Is this appropriate, Nathan? Okay. So this is appropriate. Not really a macro question, but it's not going to get me in trouble with YouTube if I read it out loud. I recently went on a date with a woman who is in medical school and will be almost $500,000 in student debt. Ay, ay, ay. When she finishes, should I run, not walk, to the nearest exit? It's really sad to say, because the answer should be you make your decision based on how well you like the gal. Unfortunately, in today's world, you've got to consider more than that. If you don't, you're setting yourself up to have big problems, especially when you look at the divorce rates, 50%, and you're taking, and this goes for guys or girls. I mean, you're basically taking on the other person's balance sheet. And do you want to take on someone's balance sheet that's got $500,000 in debt and are not even out of school? But to be fair, Nathan, I think that it would really boil down to the individual gal. I mean, if she's someone out there that isn't prudent with money and is kind of a flaky person, or then yeesh, I keep saying yeesh. It's just the first thing that comes to my mind. Let me flip the coin. If she's someone that's just sharp as a tack, is really good with money, super responsible, then I don't think I would let it affect my decision-making process. If she's not, I'd probably continue to date her, but I just wouldn't let it get too serious. I wouldn't go running to put a wedding ring on the finger there anytime soon. So that's probably the best answer I can give you. I know I'm going to get in trouble with everyone for saying that, but I just think it's great to fall in love and to do all those things. But at the end of the day, you still have to understand you're taking on the person's balance sheet. Demian asks, what are your favorite Guns N' Roses songs? Pretty much all of them. I'm a huge GNR fan. I won't give you the songs. I'll just give you Appetite for Destruction was, I don't know if it gets any better than that. It just, every single song on that album is just so awesome. I actually saw Guns N' Roses in concert twice as well. Just so good. So I kind of a cop-out answer. I'd say the whole Appetite for Destruction album. XRP Bull on the Moon. George, I was going to send a 20 super chat, but you're a millionaire. That's funny. Where can we contact you for individual consultation? You can contact Sebastian, my assistant, but that said, I don't know if I'm going to continue doing them, because it takes a lot of my time, and I'm really trying to just stay hyper-focused on doing and producing the videos and creating content that's just really as good as I can produce. And I want that to be my number one priority. And I feel as though sometimes the consultations are detracting from that a little bit. And so I might put them on hold until I'm able to achieve my goal of having 120 videos on the YouTube channel, as far as the content library that I'm really, really proud of, that I know are just awesome. And then I might cut back the videos to 3 or 4 times a week and allocate my time into either creating a digital product or maybe doing, I've had a lot of people ask me if I'd set up like a membership group. And I think that's an interesting idea. And then maybe when I do that, I might start the consultations again. But go ahead and email Sebastian. But I'm not sure that I'm going to have a meeting with him tomorrow morning and decide if I want to continue to do that the rest of this week or just hit the pause button. His email address that he uses is georgegammon, all one word, .contact@gmail.com. So that's georgegammon.contact@gmail.com. Carlos Danger, thank you for the super chat. New to your channel. You've brought me back to life, my friend. All right, Carlos. Good to hear it. Good to hear it. I've saved about 100K. I'm overwhelmed with investment options. Any suggestions? Yep. I would. I know it can be overwhelming when you watch a lot of my videos and you see the Deutsche Bank and the repo market and all this crazy inflation, inflation, deflation. But you've got to understand that if you make some prudent decisions, that you can hedge a lot of your risk. So going back to what I said earlier, if I had 100K to invest, I'd put first and foremost 10% gold, 10% speculation. I'd put, that gives you 20, you got 70 left. I'd take 50 into rental properties and linear markets, positive cash flow, 1% RV ratio. And then I'd leave 20 on the sidelines in T-bills just to take advantage of a downturn in the stock market, housing crash, something like that. Keep some dry powder and T-bills 3 months, 6 months. And also what I do too, to relieve some of that stress, Carlos, and very few people do this, but just go ahead and do like a paper portfolio of what that would look like, what I just suggested, and then stress test that against the 1970s or the 1930s or Argentina and right now. And I think what you'll see is that your portfolio would do pretty darn well regardless of which scenario we went into, and that'll help you sleep a lot easier at night and just make better decisions overall and enjoy life, for heaven's sakes. Go to Cartagena for the weekend and do some salsa dancing like I did. Fantastic on the beach during the day and salsa dancing at night. You can't beat it. Hey, Bob. Thanks for the super chat, Bob. What is the best online physical resource for finance, economics, or whatever you're an expert on? Please want to learn. I'm 20 years old, worried about the future. Hey, you're 20 years old. You got your whole life in front of you. You should be excited. I think you should be cognizant of the dangers that we have in the worldwide economy. But you should be super excited. You're 20 years old. You can make money online. I couldn't do that at 20 years old. And you've got a lot of opportunity to live in other countries, travel the world. I mean, you got your whole life ahead of you, so don't be too worried. Just be prepared. As far as my suggestions, obviously my channel, I'd suggest that first and foremost. Then I would suggest Macro Voices, the podcast. I would suggest Real Vision TV. And let's see, other podcasts. I think Shift has a great podcast. Meb Faber has a good podcast. That's more investment-driven. Jason Hartman. I'd start right there. The Creating Wealth Show, the most popular, and I think by far the best real estate investing podcast in the United States. Audiobooks. I do all of Jim Rogers' audiobooks. I would do or book or audiobook, whichever you prefer. I would read the Market Wizards books. I would read Beating the Dealer by Ed Thorpe. And that goes back to blackjack. Not that I would suggest going out and playing blackjack, but you want to learn the basics of blackjack so you can apply that to your investments in the future or your entrepreneurial career, whatever you do. And then I'd also, just for understanding how, I don't want to say you should think, but understanding the way to think through the world around you from a philosophical standpoint, I think hopefully that makes sense. I would start with Thomas Sowell, Basic Economics. And it's not just about money. He defines economics as the study of limited resources and allocating those limited resources with alternative uses. So that's not just about money and investing in finance. That's about how you use your time, how you use every single resource that we have is limited and there's scarcity. So how you use those in your own life and how the economy and the country uses those is going to help you think better about the world around you and your own personal life. Okay, guys, and believe it or not, my computer's just about toast here. I've got a 4% battery life, so I'm going to have to stop after this super chat and see you tomorrow. Patriot asks, Patriot Eki asks, thanks for your wisdom again. The Float app will do what you want to do subscription level wise. Okay. And I know I keep saying I'm going to check that out, and I'm so busy. People pay different tier levels for access to your content. You get paid in Bitcoin with no cut to Google. Okay, so it's like a Patreon with Bitcoin. Very cool. All right, Patriot, I will check that out. And for everyone else, I got to get to dinner. My computer's just about done. Thank you very much. I think we had 630 or 40 on the chat tonight, or the live stream live. That's incredible. Really just kind of blows me away. So you guys enjoy your evening, enjoy the week, and I will see you on tomorrow's video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.